Okay, well, first I wanted to say something that just came to my mind to say, it relates to some things we've been talking about, and extends in a little bit different direction. And then, just that'll be a little while, and then we'll do South Hanukkah. And then, it seems that many people still have questions about the conversation that got started about different orders of Tibetan Buddhism and the way that they have different assertions and how His Holiness talks about that. So if we get through South Hanukkah, then either later today, later this morning or this afternoon, we'll try to look at the essay that His Holiness, well, the talk that His Holiness gave, but it was really clearly a very prepared talk that he gave back in, what, about 1980 in Charlottesville, when he first started talking about how he saw it was important to overcome these sectarian differences about whether the thing that's realized in order to become free from cyclic existence is a non-affirming negative or not. And how that would not be a good thing to have inter-sectarian division over. Okay, so first my thought for today, which comes from the Great Exposition, Great Treatises, Stages and Paths to Enlightenment, is that all virtue everywhere arises from reflecting on facts with an undistracted mind. Which is, I think, of something sort of like, oh, there's a lot of words in that book, but that's kind of like something that's stuck with me. And I was like, because it seems that the one hand to have a lot of power and a lot of things that Jerome Pache is trying to say are tied up and related to it. And it sort of is a way, his way of summarizing everything that's going to be in the third volume, how it's the last two perfections, you know, of meditative concentration and wisdom. But then it's a much broader statement than that. You know, he doesn't qualify it in any way, and he intends it like that. And so, so it's an interesting thing to think about, you know, in the spirit of goldsmith testing gold and working these things in our mind, because I don't think it's very helpful or in the spirit of the tradition to just say, oh, well, that must be true, and then not ever think about it, because then you don't get past the level of just being parroting, okay, I've correctly learned the words. But you have to turn it over in your mind and think about in what ways does it seem to make sense out of things that you never understood before? In what ways do you have qualms about it? What contexts, you know, does it seem to work and so forth? So anyway, I thought about it a little bit. And one of the things that's immediately apparent is that it's not even just a Buddhist statement. It's like it's universal. I think when Jerome Pache was saying it, he was talking about everything on the path. But the way he stated it, it was everything in the universe, all beings, you know, are getting virtue from reflecting on facts with an undistracted mind. So, you know, if Buddhas have any virtue whatsoever, then they have it because of their former practice of reflecting on facts with an undistracted mind, and that this would be true of us to whatever extent we were able to generate virtue as well. And then that would also be true of, you know, anyone, whatever religious tradition or lack thereof that they were practicing or not practicing, they still could have some virtue, but it wouldn't just come from nowhere. And this is what some of us are saying. It's like, well, the people can all have some virtue if they do this sort of thing. And so the idea of facts is, first of all, very important, that that includes conventional and ultimate facts. That there are conventional and ultimate truths. That there are things that are, when we say conventional and ultimate truths, then it means, you know, not propositions, but states of things that exist, things that can be known. And so reflecting upon and knowing different kinds of things, the ultimate and the conventional, is these two parts of how we develop and strengthen these two parts of the path, method and wisdom, and compassion and compassion-based activity to help others, and insight into how everything is empty. So it's very important that that wisdom is just like sort of a warm up for seeing the ultimate, and then it all dissolves. Nor is it just kind of like an after effect of having seen the ultimate, but it's like part of the practice of the path all along, synergistically working with cultivation of wisdom, realizing emptiness. And that's why he's really saying this, is that he wants people to understand that it's not that doing, reflecting on facts means thinking about and analyzing what sort of works well, for example, with anger, to take Venerable Chogyam's book. You know, you have to like think about this and explore your own feelings and then reflect on what's going on and reflect on the teachings and how they relate to your feelings. And it's like a lot of work. It's not like just, oh, well, I'll dissolve everything into emptiness and then I'll wake up and I won't be angry anymore or something like that. So, I don't know. I like this book, Practice of the Wild by Gary Snyder, and he has a little quote in there. He says that in the end, all of us are apprenticed to the same teacher, reality. and this is in the spirit of what Jay Rinpoche is saying, because it's like, well, everybody everywhere, whether Buddhist or not, has the capacity to cultivate some virtue, but they're not going to get it by closing their eyes or turning their head or spacing out or dissolving everything. They have to get it by like thinking about the situation in it with what kind of a calm mind. That's the other part of it. You know, that is so difficult, right? To create enough calmness or stability, or he says in this place, an undistracted mind. It doesn't mean that they have to have meditative absorption. He's purposely worded this so it's much bigger than the last two perfections. It's just some similitude or something that's beginning to vaguely look like the fifth perfection is you know, some calmness or stability of mind creates a space for you being able to maintain a train of thought, be able to reflect. How can you reflect if your mind is continually dislodged and jumping from thing to thing? Anyway, I think that's a very important point that for Tsongkhapa. And I mean, I was thinking about it a little bit in terms of discussion about having a little bit about whether the method side of the path in Gelugpa is too dry and formulaic in the way it's described, and it's just kind of recipes for thinking about this and thinking about that, and there's not a kind of as much evocative quality of sort of conjuring up the vivid feelings of having strong emotions. And it made me think a little bit in this context about how, I mean, would there be other ways to cultivate? I mean, we think about positive emotions as distinct, right? Love is the wish for the happiness of another or, you know, others. But it's associated with the sense of delight in the presence of the other, and that sense of delight is not actually a thought, I don't think. It's something else. And it's important part, you know, a wetter part of that that's not exactly a thought, but goes along with a sense of closeness, you know, and affection, a sense of care. That's the right word, right? That it has not just thought, wish to be happiness, like a Dr. Spock will do the greatest good for the greatest number. Do you know what I'm saying? Yeah. So then, something like that, you know, sometimes when you hear the meditation, loving kindness, and Theravada, they don't always say anything to think about. They say, feel what it feels like to love yourself and wish well for yourself. And then try to make that, which takes a while, right? To like, may I be well. And then you say these things to yourself and sort of establish a wish, which is like a feeling also at the same time. And then just by you're trying to like make that bubble, once you have a little bubble of care established, yeah, I'm a being for whom it would be suitable for happiness to arise, and then make that get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger until it includes everything in the universe. Right? And then, you know, it's almost like I was thinking, well, where's the reflection on facts in that? It's almost like a kind of a, you know, you're starting with a generating a feeling of care and then expanding the feeling of care, but where's the syllogism to prove that you should and ought and must therefore logically make that big balloon bigger? Yes, Venerable Chogyam.
When they teach the meditation, they say to start out with somebody who has good qualities that you appreciate. And
yeah.
I usually recommend to begin with your spiritual mentor.
Yeah.
And so the way I look at it is there are some reasons behind that. You know?
Yeah.
It's just not care coming out of attachment.
Right.
But you're appreciating that person's qualities, you're appreciating the kindness they show toward you. And
yeah.
thinking about that, that makes that feeling grow.
Right.
And then...
Yeah, there's a sense of inspiration.
Yeah.
And then extending that feeling outward. Yeah. But then it's like, so, I mean, we'll have to look at Buddhaghosa and see, you know, because I mean, it's different if you look at like what this teacher or that teacher says, but if you maybe look back at the sources of the tradition and Theravada and say like, well, do they say, having developed this feeling of care, how do you get, what's the reason for applying it to Charles Manson?
They have a whole thing there.
Yeah, okay.
In Buddhaghosa, yeah. about how to deal with anger and antipathy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so much the same stuff. As
all the kinds of antidotes are developed. Because when you get stuck on each person that you're extending to thing. Okay, so then you have to have some kind of contemplation because it's like the bubble gets stuck as you're trying to grow it. And you have to stop and think about something.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So... Okay, so another kind of thought that arose in my mind when I was thinking about this is, you know, His Holiness like talks a lot about how we all want happiness and we don't want suffering, but if we were smart about that, we would realize that our happiness is really comes from the love, the care, the compassion we extend to others. That what we do for others brings us, you know, find the greatest happiness. And so then, trying to use, you know, a little bit of a judo move there in the sense of using people's wish for their own happiness and saying, well, let's just be a little more intelligent in the way that we're selfish, right? And he said that sort of thing. And then he gives these examples. It's like, well, you know, if I smile at somebody, then it's hard for them not to smile, which, you know, you see, right, how he does. And he beams at people, and then they can't help but, like, smile. Their faces light up, and then that makes them feel happier. And so that's his example, you know. See? I smiled at them, even though they were going like this, and thinking I was looking strange, I just smiled at them, and they smiled back, and then I felt even happier. So he just uses that example, like, right? And you see Thich Nhat Hanh does that kind of stuff, too, right? Talking about smiling. And so now there's all this like neurology about this. I know it's like, have you read these books about mirror neurons and so forth? Yeah. So we, you know, there's this say construct or you know scientific model that we understand our brain is including some neurons that have this kind of reflexive quality of. Firing just like when we feel sadness or we feel pain or we feel happiness, and those neurons fire. But then they also fire some subset of them, the mirror neurons, also fire in just exactly the same way when we see someone to whom we impute that same we understand that person is having that same experience, and they fire in us just as though it were happening to us. So we have that kind of resonance with the others as part of our nervous system. So why do I have to reflect on any facts? I've already got my mirror neurons, right? But then, of course, here the problem is like, well, if there are people who are close to me and, you know, that I might have a kind of biologically set up sense of level, at least within my brain, where I'm having a sense of pain at seeing their pain. Like when there's that piece of wood in their eye, right? And I was feeling uncomfortable. Yeah, it wasn't quite as bad as having a piece of wood in my eye, but it did make me squirm, right? And that's exactly that. And it wasn't from like cultivating any reflecting on any facts. It just seemed to like spontaneously arise. It's kind of like misery at the sight of someone else in misery. But then. Then, of course, this is the thing. How do you actually take that which we have as humans, it seems, as a basis and establish that as some kind of stable virtue or expand it into something that actually makes, you know, for less problems in the world instead of more? You know, you can have that kind of like, well, I'm very close to these people, and when they hurt, I hurt, and so those people over there are really horrible, and we have to destroy them because, you know, they're shooting pieces of wood over here, you know, whatever it is, you know. So then we have like, then it doesn't necessarily lead to, just if you leave it at that, that, oh, these people, you know, I have a sense of closeness to, then I'm close to those, I'm far away from these, and then we have like trouble. So virtue, in the sense of, has to be a kind of a stabilizing and equalizing and extending of the kind of raw stuff we have to work with in terms of empathy and responsiveness to the other. And it seems to me, coming back to the point we were talking about, it seems like that the only way to do that is then to do some kind of lojong, some kind of mental training of the mind, which we, you know, talk about as meditation, where you're systematically turning your mind to certain things that change, I would gather, how you know your brain is actually functioning as a basis for the arising of consciousness. It seems quite likely that that's the case. We know that people's minds change, and now they know that like there's neuroplasticity where the brain is actually changing and when people are doing those things, and it seems in a way that's corresponding to the change in the mind. So anyway, that's almost all I had to say about it, except I just want to tell this in terms of this, you know, I don't know if Jeffrey told you this story, but you know, when people are doing these kinds of things, we have to reflect, do some kind of reflections to cultivate compassion, not just try to care more. Of course, that was one of the things I always liked about Buddhism, was it didn't just say, you know, go love. But then there's like a, you know, these are the things that you should think about if you want to make your love bigger and more stable. And I just love that, you know. It's like, give me a recipe, please, you know, not just an admonition. But so, you know, we all know that one of the big recipes is to start out by thinking of all beings as your mother. Anyway, so Jeffrey, way back when he was young, went to India, and whenever he would run into Ling Rinpoche, would go, and Jeffrey was like, I must be a really special person, you know. I must be more important than I thought I was, because this is this only is his tutor, and he's just like, you know, just thinks that I'm, you know, the cat's meow and so forth. And then later, of course, he found out that Ling Rinpoche was like treating everyone as his long lost mother. Oh mom, you finally returned, and that it wasn't any sort of unique property of his internal specialness, you know, that entitled him to that treatment from the lama. So I'm looking in my Appearance in Reality book, and have the idea that the way to think about this is that there's conceptual consciousnesses and direct perceiving consciousnesses. Okay, and this is the way to make sense of the two truths in the Satchitananda system. These two kinds of consciousnesses, and with a few exceptions, and I guess important ones, like, you know, a mere absences like emptiness or unproduced space, but with a few exceptions, most of what they're concerned about as what they're going to call conventional truths are permanent phenomena that are the appearing objects of conceptual thought. And what they're considering ultimate truths is stuff that we can really perceive and touch and interact with, and stuff that changes and disintegrates. And so you have to just, like, okay, forget everything else, you know, for a second. Just try to bracket it out and say, hey, there's this stuff that's really real, and then there's the stuff we make up with our minds, and that our minds interact with stuff, but that's not the stuff that's really real. And if you read, like, Andy Carr's treatment of this, which does, by the way, even though it's a cognitive approach, take exactly that tables and chairs and all these ordinary objects in the world that we, you know, perceive with our senses, that those are the ultimate truths, and the conventional truths are these mental objects. But the upshot he draws from that is like, well, this just shows you how messed up thought is. because it's like not really in touch with the real world. That's the moral that he tries to pull out of this, you know, teaching as he's going along the ladder of tenets, to say, well, you know, you believe you have a brain, you have this concept of your brain, but let's just try to like experience what our brain is in other words, and he does these different objects where what they are to us mainly is an idea, and we don't actually have any direct experience of, so, right. Then there's some things like cup, like I haven't actually seen my brain. I just like more have an idea about it, right? So there's like, in the case of the cup, you know, it's like, this is what's called a specifically characterized phenomena, an ultimate truth, something that's truly established, something that's truly existent, something that's impermanent and changing moment by moment. And it's specifically characterized, and it can serve as a cause for me to perceive it, for me to see it. And I see it along with all the specific characteristics that qualify it, like appear, like shine towards, you know, they project their aspect, you can say, but it means that like they're able to be an active participant in they can serve as a cause in generating my perception. Of course, I also have to have sensory consciousness appropriate to that, but they're able to work and do stuff because they're not just ideas that we've made up in our mind, right? And then there's the other things, the ideas we have about things. And you know, when we say idea is a good word to play with here. You know, I use generic image in the book, but it's like when we think of idea, you know, we just think, well, like, okay, that's strictly abstract things. Like justice is an idea. We're not expecting to go, you know, out across the mountain or down the valley or to this town or that town, and then we'll come upon an object that we can perceive as justice, right? But that's different. There's also like an idea of there's ideas that we have, images that we have in our mind about things that are specifically characterized phenomena, but which either we're not perceiving at that time, or, you know, we've just finished perceiving, now we're thinking about how we perceived it, right? Mm. Right? So this is like, this question is like, well, when I remember something that I did directly experience, is that, you know, it's like most people would say, well, this is a conceptual thought. It's not a direct perception. And as a conceptual thought, the object of that is no longer, you know, the actual specifically characterized phenomena. It's a generic image, conceptual construct that's based upon that. But it's not that, right?
So what is that called?
The
idea about the thing that you formerly saw.
Well, it's called a tringy. Yeah, it's called I call it in the book a generic image. It means something that stands for the thing in the mind by which conceptual thought can get at the thing and takes as representing the thing, takes even as being the thing, but isn't the thing. It's your idea image of the thing.
So this would be conventional.
That's the conventional truth, right. And then the actual thing, like the cup.
The negation, you could say. No.
No. Not talking about that.
Okay.
Yeah.
We're just talking about
like how what we see when we walk around the world and how our minds work. And there's, I'm just saying, okay, there's minds that perceive things. Okay, let's start over again. There's this idea of a referent object and an appearing object, or what is the consciousness about? What is it getting at? What is it knowing? And then there's what's appearing to it. You know it by way of having a certain appearance in your mind. Mm-hmm. Are you following so far?
Well, yeah.
Okay.
My other note is it's all perception.
Well, what they're making a is all perception. So are you gonna, we're distinguishing between perception and conception here.
And conception.
Yes.
There we go.
There we go. That's the key thing here. Perception and conceptual thought. It's not the same thing. It's two different things that are real. Okay? So conceptual thought is not perception. It's not directly getting at any truly established objects. It's getting at conceptual constructs that it uses to stand in for objects, which it can't actually get at directly. But that doesn't mean that it can't understand. Like, we can actually, everything we just talked about is reflecting on facts with an undistracted mind. Well, these are, you know, like conceptual thoughts, so they're doing a lot of important work. When I'm thinking about my mother, I'm doing that meditation, then I'm not actually seeing my mother and noticing any specific characteristics, right, of her at that time. It's just like, you know, it's working and I'm doing work in the mind with these conceptual thoughts. And that's very different from how perception works. I'm really thinking about perception in terms of, you know, the sense perception, but then there is the idea of, you know, mental direct perception, right? If I can have the ability to see your mind and so forth like that. So here's the idea. It's that there's this image idea that appears to conceptual thought that stands for and represents it could stand for and represent an actual object that's truly existent. But it isn't that object. And so conceptual thought is always mistaken. Because even when it's right, I know that sounds weird, but this is like getting people warmed up for Sanghya. Even when you're right, even when I'm right about, you know, a state of affairs, it's still mistaken in the sense that it's taking or treating or mixing together the appearing object and the referent object. It's sort of treating this object in my mind as though it were the actual thing that I'm thinking about. You understand, like you have an idea in your mind, whatever you think about, and that's not the actual thing, right? Yeah. So, I don't know, I mean, you can, this is an example, we can, if we think of ice cream cones, there's no ice cream cones in the room, then we have a certain idea of an ice cream cone, and it seems to be just not like it seems that the way our minds work, most of the time for something like that, where we actually have seen them and, you know, tasted them, then the way that idea appears is not just like completely abstract. What sort of stands for ice cream cone in the mind when I turn my mind to it is sometimes mixed with a picture or the word ice cream cone. It's mixed with, there's the idea of ice cream cone and maybe a pistachio ice cream cone, you know, you know what I'm saying? There could be actual, this is true, it's like that people actually kind of use as surrogates little pictures of examples of things to stand in for the whole category. And they're not stupidly thinking, oh, all ice cream cones are pistachio ice cream cones. They don't think that. But still, something has to appear to their mind when they think ice cream cone. And so kind of an idea of an ice cream cone mixed with the term ice cream cone mixed with maybe some vague picture of a particular ice cream cone I once saw or imagined eating, you know, then those things appear as kind of standing for ice cream cone in my mind. But it isn't any particular ice cream cone. We can't eat it. It doesn't melt. We can't.
But we immediately want to know what kind.
Well, I always find this is an interesting thing to play around with the students sometimes. It's like, you say, I think of an ice cream cone, now what flavor is yours? And like, almost everybody knows. They never have any like purely flavorless, abstract ice cream cone. Right. Or, you know, sometimes I say, well, think of a salad, you know, and nobody thinks of macaroni salad or bean salad. Now, is it, think of a bachelor, nobody thinks of the Pope or the Dalai Lama. You know, it's just remarkable, I don't know why. But
what
means what, okay, so consciousnesses, minds, know objects. And they give us information about the world, and that can come in different ways, right? And we've talked about that earlier in terms of there's conventional knowledge and ultimate knowledge, right? And as ultimate knowledge is only getting at one particular kind of object, everything else is conventional. But this is a different way of slicing it up and saying, well, okay, there's two kinds of like ways we could get at information that's in the world. And one is conceptual, and one is non-conceptual, direct experience or perception, direct perception. Well, they both can be telling us about things, you know, telling them they can both refer to or conceive of objects or things that exist, right? So if I'm, you know, thinking of an ice cream cone or thinking about the cup, you know, the cup is a referent object, but that's not what's appearing in my mind because I'm thinking. That's the point. If I were looking at the cup, then what would be appearing to me would be the cup when I was thinking, when I was observing the cup. The cup, what you're, you know, getting at and what's appearing to you is the same, and that's what makes it direct. You know, direct, that's what makes a perception. Conceptual thought is always dissed, you know, always put down at some level, right? Like, Buddha doesn't have it, for example. And right, because... Right, because and why? Because it has this. This is the problem is that even if it's very accurate, and even if what it knows is very profound, it has this quality that what it sort of means to have a conceptual thought is to have a mental representation which stands for but is not what you are knowing. But then there is still something you could be knowing or mistaken. Right, it's not that there's wrong thought too. Right, so you could have. Non-existent, you know, the mind could imagine things that don't exist, right? And so it doesn't mean that, you know, everything that your mind is thinking about has to actually be there. But some things are and some things aren't. So conceptual thought includes all different kinds of things. It's not a matter of, and the same with perception. It's not a matter of, like, which one's good or which one's bad. You know, we try to, really, and this relates to what we were talking about a minute ago, the practice of the path is a great deal to do with, you know, the gardening thing, cultivating is gardening, you know, and trying to get the good conceptual thoughts to grow bigger and stronger, and then to at least temporarily suppress the unwholesome, unhelpful, unskillful, negative conceptual thoughts. And it's all to do, it's not to do with getting rid of conceptual thoughts initially at all, right? But then eventually, you know, the idea is to have some sort of direct experiential understanding. But that's not what you see. It starts in working with having more conceptual thoughts of this type and less of that type. So that's the general idea in Satranika, is that what is real, if you'll just let it real, or what is truly existent, is the real stuff that we perceive. And then there's other kinds of things that do exist, but they exist just as mental imputations, conceptual designations, one might say. As you see, this is like the vocabulary is like, and this is like, wait, the whole thing. And so now, when Gelupas teaches Satranika curriculum, they're getting the vocabulary and getting people warmed up to say study Prasangika. As you're using this terminology, oh. Things that are just merely conventionally designated can exist. And they can be really important to understand, you know. You know, it doesn't mean that they don't exist at all. It just, in Satranika's system, what it means is just that they're not objects of direct perception. But they're still important to work with. So, I'll just tell you what I... Let's see, let's skip over to... I think that kind of covers most of the stuff in the first several pages of that chapter, unless you end up having questions. And I'll just get to the last part of the chapter. So, actual definitions of the two truths. Several textbooks, monastic textbooks in the Gelupa order, say that ultimate truth in Satranika is that which is ultimately able to perform a function. It really can work. It really can work. So, and that which is a conventional truth is like not that which is not ultimately able to perform a function. So these conventional truths, these mental images, are permanent phenomena. They don't change and disintegrate moment by moment, and they're not able to work or carry out functions. That means that they can't. They're not just like there already, able to act and serve as a cause for me to think of it. Do you see what I'm saying? It's not like, well, this is here, and the cup is there, and so it's able to actually work as a cause for me to see the cup. But it's not like there's some, you know, if you take some abstract idea and you say, well, like, it it's something that the mind constructs, and it could be a very useful construction, but it's not like out there a priori as something that shoots itself toward the mind, and then the mind dawns like this. It's something that the mind constructs as an object. So it doesn't function, can't operate as a cause to give rise to the consciousness that's perceiving it. That's one of the it can't work as a cause, so that's one of the things that it can't cause. It can't cause also something like my idea of X, my idea image, generic image, can't act as a cause for some other idea image, right?
Why not?
Why? Because it's not. They're all produced by and constructed by the mind, from the mind side. They don't have any efficient power from their own side. Now you're thinking, well, just because they're all constructed by the mind, why shouldn't they be able to work? That's because that's your use of prasangika. But in this way of thinking, the idea of something's constructed by the mind is just constructed by the mind. It doesn't have any like oomph there on its own side whereby it can do something or make something happen.
I don't think that makes much sense to my experience, because if that was the case, I'd be not reacting to my own thoughts.
Yeah.
You're reacting to your consciousness. Your consciousness is provoking. You think of something and then you react to that consciousness.
Right.
But what he's saying is that object is permanent. It's not coming at you. But because you thought of it before, what's sparking your next thing is that consciousness that thought of that object.
Well, that's a good answer. Because it's the consciousness itself is impermanent, is able to act as a cause. But the mental object that's constructed by that consciousness is not like cups and chairs and tables. It's just something that's, that's a problem with the word idea, because idea sounds like a consciousness of an idea. But I'm talking about the idea as out there, something that is apart from the mind, that the mind is making up and holding on to. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, that I just put the idea because I was trying to think. Some meaning generality, generic image. Have these different ways of trying to talk about this, and none of them seem completely satisfactory. Generic image is the idea of that it's like it's something that's been stripped of the specific. If I'm thinking of a generic image, have a generic image of an ice cream cone. It's stripped of all the specific characteristics of an ice cream cone, so it's been made into like a generality that stands for all ice cream cones. That's the idea. We were talking a little bit about like how that works between meanings and this morning about meanings and labels. There's these two kinds of this isn't in this chapter, but there's the idea of sound generalities and meaning generalities are both different types of generic images. And so if we know the word for something or we know the term for something, then when we know, like the conceptual thought is heavily language based, but not necessarily, it doesn't necessarily have to be completely, but much of how we think is mediated by language. And so there's a mixture sometimes of the term, we could say the term generality with the meaning generality together as we think of them just kind of like as naturally going together once we learn the meaning of the word, the term for something, the label for something, then we just hold them together in our mind like that. Mm-hmm. But, I would take it that in the Satronika system, at least, that neither of these things is impermanent. Neither of them is changing moment to moment. Neither of them is able to act as a cause. You can have, the meaning generality there also even without the term sometimes, right? You can have it. So that's one set of definitions that's most often used. And then Ngawang Belden is this Mongolian Gelugpa who wrote this book on the Two Truths and the Four Tenet Systems. It's kind of an unusual book in Tibet. He chose to do his definition of the Two Truths in Satronika as that a conventional truth is a phenomenon which is established as a mere imputation by a conceptual consciousness. That's what he means by a conventional truth, thinks a conventional truth is. And an ultimate truth is a phenomenon that exists from its own side without being merely imputed by a conceptual consciousness. Yeah. So you can see, now these definitions work in the Sautrantika system, but you can see that they're being made up by Yalupa and not by Dharmakirti. And he's saying, you know, this is how we're thinking about what you're doing here. You're taking all of these objects of our senses are things that just exist from their own side without being merely imputed by conceptual thought, and that's what makes them able to work, because they're not just made up by thought. And that's the Sautrantika system. And then there's these other things that are mere imputations by thought, and we'll allow that they exist conventionally, you know, mainly as mental objects. Right? Okay. So, it's a little bit difficult to sort out, once you've made this presentation, how to explain the path in Sautrantika. So I think what would be most useful is I'll just go over and say some of the things that I thought about, and some of them I've mostly already mentioned, but maybe not all, of like how this is relevant or useful in studying, you know, Madhyamaka in the Yalupa way. Because they spend a huge amount of time on this, as you mentioned, it's like really important. First, one of the things that I thought of, and I just alluded to this a minute ago in answering a question, is that there's this idea that there's like two kinds of things in the world, and they don't contradict each other, and both exist, and each is gotten at by a different, often legitimate, type of mind. That's quite important. It's not the same two minds, and it's not the same two objects, but the structure is quite parallel to what Tsongkhapa is going to do, and he's going to say, just because, you know, the things that we think about conceptually are mere imputations by thought and only got at the conceptual thought, doesn't mean that they're refuted or superseded by the things that are perceived directly, or vice versa. These are two useful, important, legitimate kinds of things. You know, you can't sort of do without either one. Well, that's exactly what, you know, he's going to say about conventional valid cognition and ultimate valid cognition, that there's certain kinds of objects that are only got at by the conventional valid cognition, certain that are only gotten at the ultimate valid cognition. Neither contradict each other. These don't consciousnesses don't cancel each other out. You need both in order to practice the path. Now, I don't hear people talk about that, but it just reminds me so much of the structure that's here, where you have the perceptual consciousnesses, they get at certain kinds of objects, and the conceptual consciousness get a different kinds of objects, and neither one cancels the other out or sort of supersedes it, and they're both necessary for the practice of the path. Okay, so that was one point. Second point is the idea that mistaken conceptual thought, we've hit this a few times, is an absolutely indispensable tool on the path to liberation. That is, you can't, it's like, you have to think about, like, you talk about this earlier, how do you realize that things are impermanent? You have to, you know, observe, you know, the stream of your own experience and so forth, but then you have to think about what you've observed, and you have to then say, oh, I had taken this to be solid and permanent, but now I see that it's constantly changing. Well, that's thinking. Now you're having conceptual thoughts. The impermanent things are impermanent, but impermanence itself seems like now we're in the category of an object of conceptual realization. You know, you can experience impermanence as a characteristic of this cup if you have gained that kind of insight, right? But, you know, there has to be some sort of, like, conceptual meditation as part of the practice of the path to realize impermanence and then to realize selflessness. And so using mistaken thoughts as part of the practice is, you know, set up in Sautrantika, and then, of course, is, like, crucial to the way the Gyalupas are doing. Third, and I mentioned this briefly yesterday, and Anne Klein is the one who, I don't know where she got it, but she's the first person I heard say it, was that you know, when you move from Vaibhashika to the Sautrantika system, then you drop from then on the idea that the real truths are the smallest ones we get down to. And you go back, you have to say, there's like this quest for what's real that's going on. But now it's gone in a different direction. You know what I'm saying? Instead of the quest for what's real, going saying, well, there must be some sort of fundamental building block that's really small that my stream of consciousness is built out. What's the smallest possible experience that I can notice? And then how many of those could we line up to build, you know, what's happening to me in this minute? And they just stop. They stop with that and start a whole different way of thinking about what's real. Now, it's true that in Sautrantika they do still have these little tiny particles. But that's true that they do. But you don't actually, like, directly observe these particles. It's not like that they're taken as something that, you know, is able to work as the basis for your being able to observe other things. That's what I understood anyway. So there is a movement away from parts and whole. We have this parts and wholes. There's this feeling by Bhaskara that the parts are more real than the wholes, and we'll get down to the smallest part and we'll find what's real. Now they do a totally different way of thinking. Well, what's real is what we can really perceive, and what's imputed or conceptually designated is what this thought is getting at. So there's different changes the way you think. And then fourth is the idea that in order to be liberated, we have to realize that the person is empty. But the fact of the person's lacking any intrinsic nature or lacking any true existence, any substantial existence. No, not true existence. The fact of the person is lacking any substantial existence of its own is not an ultimate truth. So, right? It's a mentally constructed object. What you do is you watch in meditation the aggregates, the stream of your own experience. And then, having seen, reflected in thought upon that, you come to understand that you had falsely imputed a substantial person to those aggregates, and that there is no such thing. But that absence of a substantial person is a conventional phenomenon. It's something that's constructed by the mind. You could say it's something that's permanent. It's not something that's like in their way. It's not something that can act as a cause, you know, just from its own side and project its aspect. It's not like it's out there on its own and projects its aspect toward my mind, something like that. Okay, so that's really important, the idea that something that is merely an imputation by conceptuality, something that is a mere imputation by conceptual thought, that such a thing could be like invaluable to realize and sort of a key to liberation. It wouldn't have to be like, there are these ultimate truths, but you do have to meditate, you know, you do have to observe them and experience them in order to have something to think about. But what you actually are sort of realizing is, isn't that strange? It's like, so, you know, you get liberated through realizing a conventional truth. I mean, well, not just that, but, you know, it seems like that, you know, you have to, you're meditating on, anyway, that. And so the last thing is the flip side of that. Obviously, there's a lot of ways in which this is completely the opposite of Prasangika, and completely the opposite of where Tsongkhapa goes. And the idea here is that things can work, things can exist, things can function, things can act as causes, only if they ultimately and truly exist. Even if they say Genpa Drupa, only if they truly exist from their own side, and not just as something made up by conceptual thought. That's what they say. Things work only if they're not imputed by thought. So in other words, things that are imputed by thought can be really important, but they're not able to act as causes in the chain of dependent arising. Okay, and in their view, which is like a target now. For the other ones were like, okay, these things set up for the prasangic view. This last one is the opposite of that. It's like, well, what's the target? We got the concepts there, but they have them the wrong way, right? And so now we say, oh yeah, well, there's these things that you're claiming that things can only work if they're not just imputations by conceptuality, and that's what exactly we have to refute. Okay. So that's what I wanted to say about Satranika. Now I can answer your question either about Satranika or something else. Yeah.
So unless you're living at the time of the Buddha, as a Satranika student, then you couldn't go here anymore because you didn't see him and you just a thought. So what do you do about the Buddha? And what's their point of enlightenment?
Oh, well. No, this doesn't like stop anything from working in the way that we usually think of it. It's just, it actually, you have to think of it as like, all this is trying to describe our experience. So that experience would include meeting the Buddha, having faith in the Buddha, following the Buddha. It's not like, do you see what I'm saying? It's just trying to describe what that's like. So what is that like? Well, when you go to see the Buddha, some sensory impressions arise, right? Of what he looks like and so forth like that. And so then you form certain ideas about what you're seeing. And those ideas are based upon but different from, what you're directly perceiving, right? And then later on you go home and you remember the Buddha, but you're not perceiving the Buddha at that time. And all this stuff, faith, doubt, wrong consciousnesses, analysis, compassion, mindfulness. I mean, the idea is like all these different kinds of minds can be described and arise, and it's not like the conceptual ones are the bad ones. And do you see what I'm saying? There's all different kinds of experience. It's just that for the sake of making the clear about the two truths, we're going to say we'll divide these into the conceptual, and then. And so I guess maybe I don't get the question.
Okay, I'll try again. So, in their system, conventional truth is something that is just
made up by the mind. Right. It's constructed by the mind, but not out of nothing. Like, we have an idea about ice cream cones because we've seen ice cream cones. I have an image in my mind of the cup based on having looked at the cup a moment before, but not looking at it now, right? And so this works because the image that you made up in your mind does refer to or allow your thought in those cases to get at things that exist in the world. So you can know stuff through conceptual thought.
Right, but unless I've met the Buddha, and I'm a Satranika, then it's just a conceptual thought.
Oh, okay. Oh, I see. So if you haven't met the Buddha...
There's no Buddha.
Oh, there is a Buddha. Buddha is the referent object of your faith consciousness or your conceptual consciousness. And there is a, the Buddha is like a, you're thinking that because your thought is the object of your conceptual thought is just simply constructed, that means that the object to which your mind is thinking about doesn't exist. That's not right. It's not like that at all. We think about all kinds of stuff that exists. It's just that when we think about it, we're not actually using our mind. What we mean by conceptual thought is we have these concepts, these ideas, images, general representations of some sort that we're manipulating, and they're not the things themselves, but we sort of use them or treat them or take them as though they were the things themselves in order to figure something out or get something done in the world. It doesn't have to do whether the things themselves exist or not. Do you see what I'm saying? The Buddha exists, then we have an idea about the Buddha, and that refers to, that is in reference to an existing person, but the object of my mind at that point, that is appearing to my mind. Okay, you could say mind has two objects. I'm knowing the Buddha. And how am I knowing the Buddha? I'm knowing the Buddha by way of an object that's appearing to my mind that is not the Buddha, but represents the Buddha as an image in my mind. And when I'm thinking, I'm sort of mixing these two up, and I'm taking one for the other, and that's why they say that it's mistaken. Not because it's wrong. It's right. It could be wrong too. If I were thinking something wrong about the Buddha, it would be wrong, right? You know what I'm saying? So it could be right or wrong. But the point is mistakenness is just this mixing together of the image in my mind with the actual thing that I'm thinking about. You don't look like you're getting it.
This label is conventional.
You don't need to meet the Buddha in order to have a conceptual image of the Buddha. Because if somebody gives you a description and tells you what kind of qualities he has, you have some experience with those qualities. So based on your experience, then you form an image of what the Buddha must be like. And so it's that way that you know the Buddha. You don't have to meet him and shake hands with him.
Well, I was just also thinking of their explanation of ultimate truth, which is its existence on its own side. So the Buddha is an ultimate truth, right?
Well, the persons, I think, the persons are, I think, taken as ultimate truths. They're a special kind of ultimate truth that you still have to deconstruct and find out that they attained. This is where it gets. I was trying to bypass this because it's a little harder. But the persons are taken as ultimate truths, but they're ultimate truths that you still have to realize that they have their status or ability to function only through their connection with or being a name that's designated to the aggregates, which are ultimate truths. So the aggregates are ultimate truths, and they categorize the person also as an ultimate truth. As well, a person is an ultimate truth. The selfness of the person is a conventional truth. Everything you think is wrong. did you?
It was just that naming of ultimate and conventional truth, because if it's on the it's opposite of the way that we, study.
Right.
We're all getting kind of hung up on just this label of ultimate or conventional.
No, but it's good in that way. Yeah. It's really good in that way. It's like stretching, or, it's like you say, okay, let's take everything and sort of bracket it out and say, and then exercise our minds and think these terms don't have any intrinsic meaning. And we could build this kind of, way of thinking about the world, and how would that model work? I mean, that's the idea, is to engage in some kind of serious play, where you say it's not like, oh, if I take this seriously, I might be sucked into believing something wrong. But no, just kind of like say, all right, well, what would it be like to have to think about the world from this point of view and try to see, okay, how would this look from a Sautrantic perspective and play with the ideas in that way, and then you get some sort of understanding that it is a way to model the world. It runs into problems, but then other models do too. It's really an important one. It's an important one, really, in the history of Indian Buddhism, even if you leave the whole Tibetan story out of it. It's not some marginal, obscure thing. Dharmakirti is huge, right? As we mentioned, people argue a lot in Tibet about exactly how to read Dharmakirti. But the Gelugpas are obviously hugely important to Tibet. They have their hugely important interpretation of this hugely important Indian school that they make as kind of, as I was saying, the bedrock of their curriculum, partly to set up some of the things they're going to say later, and partly to set up some targets against what they're going to say later, to shoot. Yeah. Okay. Yes.
Well, I'm back at a question I had with Geshe Dorje Damdo, which is, I'm just going to say my experience in a nutshell is, I didn't go to academia. I came from Karma onto Venerable Thupten Children's books, and Prasangika made sense. That's how it seemed.
Yeah.
Checking, meditating. It seems like that, that seems like that again. Then, quite a few years later, 6 or 7, Geshe Dorje Damdo comes and teaches all this tenant stuff, which I never heard about, never read. I don't find it particularly useful. And so I'm just saying that's my experience. And I, of course, I haven't delved into every, I don't know if you can, except academics, to go into everything. But when you lay out the four things, or the three things here, how studying Sautrantika will help Prasangika, I go, oh, well, someone can just tell me these. And I'm good with it. Two kinds of things in the world are contradictory, two types of mind get at it, mistaken conceptual thoughts, a necessary step. It's like, okay, so I have a lot of resistance to spending this kind of time on this stuff. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I didn't know. You just explained it very clearly.
Tell me why
you should bother.
Not with everything, but with
the tenet system.
It's a way to study, and as I understand it, and better understand the Prasangika model. But
I think it does help.
That way.
You don't think so?
Well, I'm just not experiencing it that way.
Well, let me just say that it's like, when we just use these words, okay, well, everything's been conceptually designated by thought and so forth, and things are truly existent and not truly existent, things are substantially existent, not substantially existent. It's like, I find it helpful to understand that it's not just one day Chandrakirti and Tsongkhapa started using this vocabulary, that it like has, like people have been using these words and trying to sort out what they meant and using them in different ways. So that, for me, that's one thing, is that like, it puts the philosophy in a context. It shows you, when people are saying, okay, this is the view, it's like, they didn't just pick it out of a hat. It's like, they've established it as what they think is the middle view way and the final view in relationship to other options. And certain things that people say have a history of being said in a certain way in order to make a contradistinction to something else that you don't know about if you haven't studied any other system. That's point number one. The second is that I think that it's useful in terms of developing tolerance of like different Buddhist ways of modeling the world. That relates to what we were talking about the other day in a very different context. But it isn't just like there is this view because that's the view in our particular lineage. There's like been lots of different, very deeply argued, thoroughly thought out, and completely different from ours, Buddhist ways of modeling how the world works. And this is like a way of doing it that doesn't get into in the Tibetan context. It didn't get into, initially at least, the sect versus sect thing, because everybody that they were talking about was gone. All these ideas were, you know, sort of so you can like think about like, well, there's these different, but then of course they're all hierarchically laid out. So in that way, and this is how it's usually presented, I mean, it's not really taken for granted that everybody will find the Prasangika view to be simpatico. You know, people will find it to be that people will feel that they ought to find it simpatico because that's what their teachers are advocating as the highest view. But it doesn't necessarily follow that it will be the best view for them. And that's why, as I, you know, Kensuri Yeshi Tuten, one of our teachers, told us that that's why he said you should consider that there are people who, from their own point of view, actually hold all of these systems in Tibet, and they're not just in one or the other of the Chirluk, you know, they're in different systems. Now, I haven't met all the Nyingma Vaibhashikas and the Kagyupa Sautrantikas and so forth, but I think that you really have to leave open that space that as often said, these views increasingly have more radical views of emptiness, and they have increasingly less substance left over on the object side as you go up. It's in this schema anyway. If you go in Carr's schema, they have less substance until you get to the next at the top, and then they have more substance at the top. But in this way, they have increasingly less substance. So it's like you're climbing up a thinking of the middle way as like a narrow ridge that goes through like a pass up ahead. But first you have to get up on the narrow ridge in order to like tiptoe along the ridge to get through the pass. Okay, so we're down here, and it's like a, you know, we have to try to get as far up this, like this here, this like steep but gradual incline, you know, and that represents these different rungs. So like, how much are you willing to let go of the idea of substantial existence, but you still feel like you have to have something, you know, like true that's on the object side, like Sautrantika? Or are you willing to sort of think about how everything could be of one entity with the mind? And how much are you willing to negate and within the context of which you can maintain faith, confidence, mm-hmm. in that what you do makes a difference in the world, that karma has consequences. And that's the idea, is that, like, well, look, it could be that objectively, the karma works perfectly fine, and not only that, only works if you adopt the prasangika view. But if for an individual person, you know, starting to say, well, I have to take that prasangika view, that means that, like, dependent arising is destroyed, then that person hasn't been helped at all. And Tsongkhapa's experience was that was not just a theoretical, that was actually the case. That almost, that the people who were before him, very roughly speaking, and not including everybody, but roughly speaking, the people who said, we're really going to go with the Madhyamikas, there were ones who preferred Svatantrika kinds of approaches because they wanted a little more solidity. And then there are the ones who went to Chandrakirti, and mostly, from Tsongkhapa's point of view, mostly those people end up being nihilists in his interpretation. So he thought that people who were going to the prasangika view and that is so much of the great treatise that is not replicated in the middling treatise later on, but so much of it is devoted to cataloging all these misinterpretations of prasangika which have plagued people, and I mean in detail saying this is really what they seem to be saying, trying to understand what these people are saying, and then saying why he thinks it's wrong, and then going on to the next one, right? So the point is that different views could be suitable for different people, and it may not, and from that point of view it's helpful to have this sort of a menu of legitimate Buddhist philosophical positions. Because, I said, these are all have the four seals stamp of approval, right? They're legitimate Buddhist views. Holding a Vajrayana view doesn't make you not a Buddhist, even in Kensei Norbu's book, right? Yeah. I guess that's all I can think of. That may not be all there is to say about it, or maybe I missed something, but that's what I can think of, yeah.
In the Svatantrika system, it seems that what they're saying, however they define the terms, that things that exist ultimately are ultimate truths, and things that don't exist ultimately are conventional truths.
That's right. Oh, I didn't think of saying that, but that's exactly right. Mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah, I should have said that. But that's important. Yeah. Because, of course, that's not the way prasangika is going to do it. They're going to say, like, everything exists only conventionally, including the ultimate truths. But, that's very different from, like, in the history of Buddhist philosophy in India, it's like, as this two truths idea was developing, I think it's very often that the idea of two truths emerged out of what seems to be true when we take an ultimate point of view will be the ultimate truth, and what seems to be true when we take a conventional truth will be a conventional truth. When in Sutra Buddha speaking from a conventional perspective or within conventional terms, then we'll say that those statements are conventional truths and refer to conventional realities or conventional truths. And so this idea of the adverbial form was like taken as like creating a framework within which you would establish that kind of reality or object. And that's not the case, obviously, in Madhyamaka.
Why do you use the expression ultimately able to perform a function? Why don't you just say able to perform a function? I don't understand what a function
means. Oh, yeah. I didn't... maybe not necessary. Things ultimately existing, things able to perform a function. Right. That would be fine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Things work. If they're impermanent, they work. They're able to perform functions. Yeah, sorry. Yep.
I think that it's important also because if you're going to say that your view is right, then you should probably know why it's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And along those lines, I was wondering if you could, you said some things, but if you could maybe talk a little bit about Tsongkhapa's view. You hear a lot about, you said a lot about how it, kind of cuts off those two extremes.
Mm-hmm.
And how that's one reason why it's so important in his work with the genius, this kind of thing. But I'm wondering if there's some, really specific, concrete examples of problems that come up in some of the other views mm-hmm. you know, coming from the, you know, Tsongkhapa's view. Specific, like maybe really specific to the path, like, you know, maybe...
Right.
I don't know. Does that make sense?
Yeah, okay. It does. Okay, people taking this idea that what you find when you look at things ultimately is the ultimate truth and therefore must be ultimately real. There were people who felt that a mind that looks into what things are ultimately must find something that ultimately exists. And then they would say that this thing is ultimately real and other things aren't. Okay, so this wasn't just like a few people. There wasn't just one version of this idea, but it was like a very logical idea. And the problem was, from Tsongkhapa's point of view, is like now if you can say this, there's, when you look for what things are really, you find some real thing. Now it's no longer true. What, in the Heart Sutra, where everything is empty, there's one non-empty thing, and that's perfection of wisdom itself. You know, it's like everything else is empty, but when we finished, you know, showing how, from the point of view of emptiness and mind realizing emptiness, all these things are empty, what is it we find? We find emptiness. And so emptiness is the real ground, okay, for everything else. Now, that Tsongkhapa thought that was a problem, because he's saying, now you're not really saying that everything's empty. You're having this one real thing that you're going to be attached to. And then there were even some people who said, if there's one thing that's really real, then the most important thing for us is to tune our minds into that. If I could just, to make a rough comparison, like God. It's not God. And then they didn't talk like that exactly, but the idea is that, you know, why worry about so much about this world and these illusory appearing things which are all empty? If there's one thing that's really real, we'll just focus on that. And so then there becomes like, there's one thing that's absolutely real, and then the idea is, so we should really turn our attention and worry about that instead of worry about anything else. It was just normal. I mean, he wasn't like the Dalai Lama, who had a responsibility for trying to bring everybody together in Tibet and be nice. He was trying to carve out, you know, how his, what he was saying was different from other people. So he wasn't calling people names, but he could be sharp and clear about drawing differences. And so he says, some Tibetans don't posit the ultimate truth as a sheer elimination of the elaborations of the object of negation. That is, they don't think the ultimate truth is the sheer elimination of the two selves. Instead, they say that as the object of a mind that non-mistakenly knows just how things are, this ultimate appears to exist under its own power. It exists in and of itself. Well, of course, this is what Nagarjuna was warning against in Tsongkhapa's reading, at least in the 24th chapter. He says, like, emptiness is to cure you of your attachments, and then if you become addicted to emptiness, then what are we going to do for you? Well, this is how Tsongkhapa doesn't quote that here, but that's what he's understanding it, is that people are saying that, you know, well, if something is true from an ultimate point of view, it must be ultimately real, and let's just focus on that instead of all this other nonsense. So, and that's what he goes on to say. So, to ascertain that the ultimately real is absolutely and really real is the wisdom that knows the profound. It's not realizing the absence of an intrinsic nature in me such that I become attached and, you know, in my anger gets like gasoline poured on it because I know that person is spawn of Satan. You know, existing naturally from their own side is like a source of bad actions. No, it's not like that. It's not like that at all. It's just like I need to turn my mind to this ultimately really real thing, right? And so he ridicules that. He said, these kinds of assertions stand outside the sphere of all Buddhist scriptures, Hinayana or Mahayana. Because these people say that it's necessary to stop the idea of self that ties living beings in cyclic existence. And then they say that if you don't stop this conception, but that you don't stop this conception of self by realizing the lack of intrinsic existence in the aggregate, or in the person that's imputed the aggregates. Instead, you stop it by knowing as truly existent some other phenomenon. And then yeah, there's like, there's no, he said, this would be just like this, and this is where, you know, he's like, it's clear that he's very unhappy with that. So, suppose that that there's no snake in the east, but someone really thinks there's a snake in the east and is terrified. So you will say to that distressed person, hey, you're not going to stop the idea that there's a snake in the east by going over there and looking and thinking about it and realizing in the east there's no snake at all. No. Rather, you should think, there's a tree in the west. That will stop your idea that there's a snake in the east and will end your distress. Okay, so you can see, I don't know what to make of it. He's just obviously really wants to make it clear that he thinks that that's going in the wrong direction, and he's not tolerating it in the way, I mean, he means like explicitly that he doesn't really think that people maybe in good faith have, you know, gone down this road of thinking, well, things that we find by an ultimate mind must be the ultimately real things, and therefore let's just focus on those. And then by doing that, they getting away from the idea of like analytically refuting their own misconceptions about how they exist. It's like, well, you don't want to bother with that, and just focus on your mind on this ultimately really real thing. Okay, so that's one thing. But another way is that many people, as I was just mentioning before, would classify themselves as followers of Chandrakirti. Okay, so there's different things. Not everybody said Chandrakirti had the highest view, right? Some people said, well, Chandrakirti was too nihilistic, you know, because he didn't consider this really real thing that we found, you know. And so we're going to say that he has to be interpreted. But there were other Tibetans who said, yeah, we're going to follow exactly what Chandrakirti says. And he tells us, like, that, you know, nothing exists, really. Everything's posited by ignorance. You say, Gunzo Denba, you know, jerk truth, you know, as Jeffrey translates it. This is like, everything that we're seeing all the time is just truth for jerks. And if we would stop being such jerks, then everything would disappear. And so basically, you know, the meaning of Chandrakirti's teaching is like that there are no convention. There's no such thing as conventional knowledge. There's no such thing as, you know, legitimate conventional existence. Conventionalities are just, you know, a fiction that there's this fictive process of, you know, of path and fictive as if process of getting enlightened, but there are no, just if you just put it bluntly, you know, there are no ordinary things that exist. It's just made up. And so there isn't really any basis then for talking about distinction between right and wrong. Or you can say, as he put it in the passage I was reading yesterday, you know, well, these teachers maybe will still sometimes want to teach right and wrong, but they don't have any like philosophical basis for explaining this, except this, you know, put faith in me and you'll realize, you know, it would be good for you to do like this or good to do like that. But you can't, since ultimately nothing exists, there's not any foundation for the ethics to be grounded upon. So this would be a way that, like, Tsongkhapa truly felt that many people who tried to follow Chandrakirti, most of the Tibetans before him, presumably, were falling to a nihilistic extreme. And in order to avoid that, other people were saying, well, we're not really going to go with Chandrakirti. We're going to go with this idea that there's an ultimately really real thing that's found by the ultimate wisdom, right? Which is what then the whole system becomes about, is that, and not the process of analysis. So anyway, I guess that's what I could say about how Tsongkhapa's system positioned itself, you know, in relationship to the other views that were there at that time. That he really felt that there were real people who were being harmed by real misunderstandings that were not just spotty here and there, but were pervasive throughout Tibet at his time, and that went to both extremes, right? And that it was sort of indispensable for him to not just be nice and say, well, here's another way you could think about it, but to sort of lay it out very clearly that these other ways of looking at things have gone astray. That's what he tried to do. As far as, like, I was mentioning this morning at breakfast that I feel like, you know, when I, having spent so much time with the Great Treatise, and when I channel the voice of, you know, I say, well, this is how Tsongkhapa says in the Great Treatise, or I speak from within that, you know, frame, that it's not the same voice or framework that His Holiness uses now at all. And now His Holiness is like grounded in, it's not like there's a difference in the philosophy between His Holiness and this book. It's that Tsongkhapa was interested in carving something out and making it clear where the boundaries are. And His Holiness is like in this situation of the last, you know, few decades where he's seeing that these boundaries are problematic, and they're it's not useful or helpful for Tibet or Tibetans or Buddhism to emphasize these things. And we want to try to like use his powers of analysis to try to bring people closer together by pointing out, like, well, so anyway, we don't have enough time, but if we look at have you guys actually read the last talk in this book? It's very difficult. It's called The Union of Old and New Translation Schools. So I've read it over and over and over again, and I'm starting to understand it a little bit now. I thought, you know, it could be related to some of the... It's like a way to talk about this problem of that His Holiness is trying to overcome sectarian division, but, you know, without necessarily getting into the Shandong issue, but saying, like, well, how he's been doing this from independently of that for a long time. But that's too much to get in. We'll do that in the afternoon. Yeah, you have another question? Yeah. No, did I help a little bit, or no?
Yeah. I mean, well, I have one little follow-up, I guess.
Okay.
It would be just sort of a very broad general stroke, which would be, he wouldn't have said, you can't achieve Buddhahood with these other views, right? He was simply saying, these other views have the flaws. I mean, you could be enlightened. There were people who became enlightened with these other views, but that they're problematic for a larger group. Like maybe even those people just kind of got lucky.
Oh, no. I know exactly what you're saying now. Yeah. Okay. Tsongkhapa would have and basically did say that you can't get enlightened with other views. So that makes the job harder for His Holiness, because what he can't say, oh, Tsongkhapa was wrong about that. Let me add a footnote. That, and also, he wouldn't say that because he doesn't believe that. But then on the other hand, he has to dig deep in a way to find, you know, a basis for legitimately talking about the fact that you just pointed to, which His Holiness acknowledges as the fact that there are adepts, highly attained persons who don't seem to have, you know, like, for example, he says, there were people who became highly, you know, accomplished in Tibet spiritually before Tsongkhapa explained this. He says this in this thing. It's like, well, how would one explain this from, you know, the point of view of a Gelugpa partisan, right? So that qualm that you're bringing up is like, well, how could anybody be enlightened if they weren't following Tsongkhapa? He uses that as part of his evidence, I think, to undermine a kind of narrow sort of Gelugpa partisanship.
Well, also, it's part, you know, he often says that people attain high stages of Tantra without having the Prasangika view. Mm. But he doesn't state what he means by high stages of Tantra.
Yeah.
Because you can still absorb the winds into the central channel and have all of this without the right view. Even the Hindus do that.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I sort of feel like it's too much to start now, but I thought I went through this and marked some sections, and I'll try to like go through and say what I think he's saying. It's not that we can understand everything about it, but I think you can get the gist if we go through that, what he's trying to say in answer to your question. And I read it last night, and then I read it again this morning, and then in between I had a dream, which I dreamed that that Longchen Rabchan, the Nyingma master, and Tsongkhapa were like holding hands like at full arm's length. and that then they were dancing in this sort of a minuet where each one took turns leading the other one around, but they weren't like getting any closer than others. And then in the dream there was like the where they were dancing was sort of over like a open sewer of cyclic existence. But they were just above it. Like that far above. Anyway. Yeah. I think that's right. Yeah. Anyway, that was my dream. Well, if you read this, you'll see it obviously comes from reading that. It's like that. We can't start that now. We have to wait. Okay.